Hamburgers, hot dogs. 10 minutes. I don't need that one. I don't need this one. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5 tells us that when now Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountain and sat down, and his disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. This is a message for his disciples. A message from a king to his followers. This is a message about what it meant to be a citizen of that kingdom. These are people who have heard Jesus, seen Jesus, and have decided he is the promised one. He's the anointed one. He is the Messiah. That word disciple is so important because it means they have devoted themselves to being the students of this teacher. They want to look like him, sound like him, act like him, and to be honest with you, culturally, given the regions that they came from, they wanted to smell like him. Was he a fisherman? Was he around the masonry work? Was he in the carpentry? They wanted to be just like him. The first 16 verses of Matthew chapter 5 describe character. The rest will describe conduct, but character comes first. We like to switch things around. We think that our doing will result in our being. That is the natural instinct. And Jesus says, no. Your being will result in the doing. Character comes before conduct, being before doing. How radical Jesus' words must have been, must have seemed to those who are listening to him. Words like poor and mourn. Be so sad that it cannot be contained. It has to have an outflow. Mourn. Humble. Consider that. Our world loves the humble, don't they? Humble. Hunger. Thirst. Pure. Be persecuted. These words are no less radical today. We live in a world of decadence and indulgence and greed and violence. A world that values compromise. A world that is arrogant to the extreme, saying that sin doesn't matter. A world in which truth is relative, if it exists at all. A world in which hypocrisy is normal. A world that values pride, self-interest, self-initiative, independence. God did not create us to be independent of him. God did not create us to be self-sufficient. God did not create us, brothers and sisters, to be independent of each other. We live in a world that demands social justice and peaceful utopia here, now. We live in a world that gathers around God in only the most desperate of times. We relegate him to the dustbin, to the outskirts, not for public sight, until we don't know what to do. We live in a world that questions whether he even exists when we see the effect of our own sin. The entire time, Jesus has been speaking directly to these disciples of his followers, and he is saying to them, my kingdom is not of this world. And as citizens of my kingdom, he tells them, you must realize your deepest need. You must understand that yearning that is deep down in your heart, the desire of your soul. And you must mourn your sinful state, your brokenness, your emptiness. And you must have a thirst for righteousness, for purity. You must have pure motives and internal strength in a world that values external strength. You must be strong, but gentle and humble. And you must have empathy, he's telling his disciples, empathy for people who are as you were. And you must desire to bring my restoration into their lives. And you will be persecuted. Does this sound like a message that's going to draw people? You will be persecuted because I'm going to be persecuted. These are his words. He says, but I'll comfort you, and I will be merciful to you, and I will quench your hunger and your thirst. And you will see and experience the hand of God in your life, and my kingdom will be your kingdom. Salt. What do you think about when you think of salt? Maybe you're like this. Doctors, stay away from salt. I'm like, hey, we're Italian. Sorry. Like salt and everything. In fact, if you can't crunch it, it's probably not good, you know. What did salt mean to them? For us, we live in a world with modern technology that allows us to separate salt from its earthly organic matter. We have a very, very pure chemical compound that sits on our dining room table. This is pure salt. It's uncontaminated. You never hear of an outbreak of some illness because of contaminated salt. You know, salt is understood in the first century. People who are gathered around Christ, they didn't have modern technology 2,000 years ago that could do that. In the place and time of Christ, salt was found in the marshy seashore, and I had to say that very slowly because it's like a rhyme and I can't do it. Marshy seashore along the Dead Sea. Or it was found in inland deposits where the water had dried up for the season, the summer heat. And they could not completely separate the salt component from the earthy organic material. Imagine finding some of this deposit and it's all mixed in and trying to wash away the organic material. What's going to happen to the salt? It's going to turn to liquid and go away. It's going to dissolve. So finding salt deposits that were high in content, salt, and low content, earthy, organic, natural materials was very important to the society. It was very important to their way of life. Honestly, it was very important to their survival. Why? Because you can't kill an animal every day to eat for that day. If you were going to slaughter an animal, it's a huge sacrifice, and it has to be sustained, and it has to pull your family through for a long time, and you can't have it rot. You have to preserve the food to the best of your ability so that it'll last as long as possible. Deposits that were high content salt were extremely, extremely valuable. The purer the salt was used to preserve food from decay and to enhance the flavor was very expensive. The more pure, the more value. And it should be noted that when salt is added to something as a preservative, it brings out the flavor of, have you ever tasted salt by itself? It's not so hot, you know. But in the food, it enhances the natural flavors of the food, but it also does something else. What does it do? It makes you thirsty. It creates thirst. So if a high content salt deposit is left unattended and exposed to the elements around it, the deposit's saltiness is diluted and worn away, and what's left was weak and tasteless. Salt left unattended becomes weak and tasteless. What was once very expensive, common, some would say is now worthless. No big deal. In fact, it's, you know what they would do with salt that had become weak and tasteless? They would throw it down out on the streets and on the pathways. They would even throw it on the floor of the temple to keep people from slipping. It was used as sand or common gravel. What was once so valuable could now become something trampled underfoot. Look at Matthew 5:13. Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. I want you to hear what they heard. You're a rare and highly valued commodity. Your presence in the world literally prevents decay around you. Your presence enhances flavor. Your presence creates thirst in those around you, a desire for me. But be careful. Be careful. The more you leave yourself unattended and the more you're exposed to the earthly natural elements around you, the less I can do with you. That word tasteless is actually an interesting word. It means to make something useless, or listen to this one, foolish, to turn to foolishness. Tasteless means to turn to foolishness. This Greek word is very important. Sometimes we say that a comment or a joke is tasteless. Okay, that's what this is talking about. This Greek word is the same word in which from which we get our English word, one of my favorite words, moron. Okay, I'm not allowed to use that word anymore when I'm driving. Right, Gianni? Sitting at a stoplight, someone else honked. I had nothing to do with this. Beep, a Chicago honk. And out of the back of the van I hear, ah, you moron. And I just stared out that front window as my wife went, Bleep. She's like, where did he, Johnny, where did you get a word like that? Jesus is saying that this kind of salt becomes dull and sluggish. It has no edge to it. It's not sharp. It's acting stupidly. It's silly. Remember the conversation that we've had so many, many times about studying the words in the text, common, holy, common, what? Detestable. What was once so highly valued, what is so rare, has become worthless. Used only for being trampled underfoot. It's no longer good for anything. It literally is no longer strong. It's no longer able to resist decay. The relevance of light. Modern technology allows us to flip a switch. Well, now with the squirrely things, we have to wait about 30 seconds for it to light up to full strength. But we used to flip a switch and have instant light. Instant light. They didn't have modern technology 2,000 years ago. In the time and place of Christ, light was rare. And light was a valued resource. And it took time to get, and it was not easy to keep. There are three things I want you to consider about light. Number one, rabbis in Israel, the most respected or revered rabbis were called, forgive my Hebrew, Ner Olam. I don't know, Ner Olam. But it means light of the world. So you have all these rabbis in Israel, the most respected and revered ones were called, it's the light of the world. He's the light of the world. Number two, we've just read that Jesus has been traveling around from city to city to city throughout Galilee, and the people are following him from city to city, and these cities are built on hills. Why? They're harder to attack. They're easier to protect. They can be seen from far away, and from the city you can see far away. And they're easily recognizable as a point of destination. You build cities on the hill, not in the valley. Number three, a candle in a niche. Their oil lamps were small, little clay lamps, maybe slightly smaller than this. Small little clay lamps with a little wick that would absorb just a few tablespoons of oil. And it would be placed in a niche on a wall or a little stand high in the room so it could light the whole room and everyone in that room could see it. Oil is expensive. It is today even. The wicks needed frequent trimming and they needed constant care. The light or life that was well lit or well placed is like an insightful teacher or a city on a hill or a lamp in a niche that expels darkness. Protection, provision, guidance and direction. Look at Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. What did they hear? You shine brightly. You are the ones who bring insight. You are unmistakable. Everyone will see you. And you give a sense of direction. You give a sense of destination. You expel darkness. Warning. If you hide your light, what good are you? Have any of you ever played that game with a candle or a lamp and snuff out its oxygen source? What happens? Light goes out. What happens to a light under a basket? Goes out. Three things that we might miss in this passage. Three verses, three little verses. Here, three things we might miss. Salt of the earth, light of the world. This passage is about character while in this world. Character while in this system. Character while we're here. If we are believers in Jesus Christ, if we have been born again, if we have second birth, spiritual birth. We are citizens not of this kingdom. We are citizens of His kingdom. And why are we here? The text tells us that we are here as ambassadors, not here for our own agenda, but here for His. Just simply giving His message to those who are here. Number two, why does he keep saying this? Do you see those sentences in there? That they may glorify your Father in heaven. Remember the people who are overhearing this conversation? You know, remember the people, the masses, who are eavesdropping on this conversation that Christ is having with his disciples? What do they expect of the Messiah if they're Jewish? Or what are they expecting of a king if they're Greek, Roman, Syrian? Whether wealth or power or destruction of enemies or a utopian kingdom of heaven on earth or even just simply peace, what Jesus is saying as they are listening doesn't match up, doesn't jive with any of those things. He tells them plainly that as citizens of a heavenly kingdom, it's not about our agenda here. It's not about our hopes and our dreams and our pursuits and our timeline, our plans. It's simply about God being glorified. I know that theologians will go back and forth on what the word glorified means or to glorify God, but the best definition of giving God glory that I've heard, that I can understand, and can wrap my simple mind around it, is enhancing his reputation. Enhancing his reputation. That's why we're here. As a born-again believer in Jesus Christ, we exist to enhance his reputation. Show who he is. Number three. You are, he tells these disciples, the salt of the earth. You are, he tells these disciples, the light of the world. This is not something that you strive to be. This is not something that you can achieve someday down the road. I'll get there. This is not a definition of the goal. This is who you are. This is how you have been recreated. Unfortunately, so many people get a little bit of ahead of the text here, and they take the verses, these last few verses with a warning about character, and they put it into conduct. And I believe in evangelism dearly. And I believe in missionaries dearly. Jesus is hope. Jesus is peace. Jesus is joy. There's no other name under heaven by which someone can be saved. Jesus said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, and no one can come to the Father except through me. So either he's a liar, he's crazy, or he's telling the truth. Evangelism, witnessing, mission is very, very important, but that is not. This is not the anchor verse of doing. These are the anchor verses of being. While I firmly believe in evangelism, please understand that this is Jesus' warning to citizens of his kingdom about their character, which, as he just described, if we leave unattended, or if we leave hidden, or if we leave the character that he's placed in us exposed to the natural elements around us, is good for nothing. It's tasteless. It's dark. It's common. You cannot become salt, Christian. You cannot become light, believer. These are the characteristics endowed and appropriated upon becoming a citizen of his kingdom, submitting to the call of salvation in your life. And as citizens of his kingdom, you are salt and you are light. What you are able to do, however, warning, you ever see that big flashing warning sign? Is lose your saltiness and hide your light. Our responsibility is not to change character. Don't confuse personality and character. Our responsibility is not to change character. He does that work in us. He says, that's my job from beginning to end, and I'll be faithful to complete the work which I began in you. He's the one who changes character. Our responsibility is to attend faithfully to what he is doing. Do not remain in this system. Do not believe the principles and the philosophies of this system. And do not hide. Do not hide what it is that he is putting in you. His principles, his philosophies, his values. You understand why these words are so radical? Reflect for a moment on who he is talking to, where he is. He is on a mount, surrounded by masses, crowds, filled with Romans, Greeks, Syrians, in the Jewish community, Sadducees and Pharisees and Essenes and Zealots. And these are the very people who are decadent and indulgent and greedy for wealth and affluent and politically connected and powerful and mighty and prominent and pious. And in the midst of all those masses, he has drawn close to him a small group of those who desperately want to hear what he has to say. Out of all the masses of people around us, Christ is drawing a small group who are desperate to hear what he has to say. Are we like that small group sitting at his feet? Do we know our spiritual poverty? Have we come to grips with it? And do we mourn uncontrollably our emptiness and our brokenness and our weakness? Are we ever increasingly hungry and thirsty for what is pure and righteous for him? Are we humble, gentle? Are we merciful and empathetic to other broken, empty, weak people? Do we desire godly reconciliation in their lives as much as we do in our own? Are we called the children of God, his sons and daughters? If you've had that moment in your life where you've said, you know what, I give in, I give up. You're right. I'm wrong. You're holy, and I'm a sinner. Please forgive me. And I want your life in me, and I want my life in you. If we've had that moment, you are a rare, and highly valued commodity. Christian, believer, born-again saint, your presence prevents decay. Your presence enhances flavor. Your presence increases thirst in those around you. You shine brightly. You bring insight. You are unmistakable. Everyone will see you. You give a sense of direction. You give a sense of destination. You expel darkness. But as he's concluding this list of character traits for the citizens of his kingdom, it comes with the warning, you cannot strike a balance between worldliness and godliness. It's one or the other. And the more of the world, the natural element that is in you, the less valuable and usable you are. And you cannot strike a balance between good and evil. It's one or the other. And either His light in you is piercing the darkness, or the darkness of this world is hiding your light. We've just studied the book of James. Does this not sound as though James was in the crowd while Jesus was on the mount? 16 verses of character. 16 verses of quality traits, attributes of citizenship in His kingdom, culminating with a huge warning. Do not dilute, hide, or leave unattended the work of Jesus in your life.